Introduction. Chapter 1. Dissecting the Divine. In June 2018, news platforms across much of the world published a photograph of God. "Does this photograph show the true face of God?" shouted one clickbait headline. "Science reveals the face of God and it looks like Elon Musk," teased another. Others, including NBC's website, were rather less sensationalist in their headlines. "The face of God is in the eye of the beholder." The photograph in question showed a fuzzy, black-and-white image of a middle-aged, beardless Caucasian male with a soft, rounded face and just a hint of a smile. The image was produced by researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who showed a demographically representative sample of US Christians, a series of computer-generated faces embodying certain cultural stereotypes of emotional, ethical, social, and spiritual values, and asked them to select those faces perceived to best reflect their mental image of God. Some of the faces were androgynous in appearance, while some were more feminine and some more masculine. All the faces were grey, like a black and white photocopy, but some were lighter skinned and some were darker skinned. Some faces were expressive, some were seemingly blank. But each face was a canvas onto which the experiment's participants were free to project their own assumptions. The results were averaged out and used to create God's E-fit. Unsurprisingly, the study revealed that in the US, God is made in the image of a white American man. Psychologists and social anthropologists have long understood that a very heavy dose of cognitive bias underlies the construction of the divine in human societies. But while modern studies like those conducted at Chapel Hill can tell us something of the psychological and social processes underlying this tendency, this is hardly news. Over 2,500 years ago, in the late 6th or early 5th century BCE, the Greek intellectual and adventurer Xenophanes of Colophon had already arrived at a similar conclusion. If cattle and horses or lions had hands or were able to draw with their hands and do the works that men can do, horses would draw the forms of the gods like horses and cattle like cattle, and they would make their bodies such as they each had themselves. For Xenophanes, the human tendency to make gods in our own image was as much about local cultural preferences as overarching lofty ideals, as the diversity of deities in his world attested. The Ethiopians say that their gods are broad-nosed and dark-skinned, the Thracians that theirs have blue eyes and red hair. As far as Xenophanes was concerned, the widespread assumption that the gods had bodies like those of their worshippers was inextricably linked to the notion that deities behaved very much like humans, and this was deeply problematic, for it inevitably cheapened the moral nature of the divine. Proof could be found in the Greek myths themselves. Homer and Hesiod have attributed to the gods everything that leads to blame and abuse among men, stealing, committing adultery, and deceiving each other, Xenophanes complained. It was an objection rooted in his philosophically driven insistence that a god was inherently and necessarily a being in no way like mortals, either in body or thought. Similar ideas were soon championed by other Greek thinkers, most notably Plato, circa 429 to 347 BCE, his student Aristotle, circa 384 to 322 BCE, and subsequent generations of their elitist, learned adherents in the Greco-Roman world, who theorised that the divine power ultimately undergirding the universe and everything in it was necessarily without a body, an incorporeal, invisible, abstract principle, force or intellect, wholly beyond and distinct from the material world. Not that these rarefied views made much of an impact on the religious lives of ordinary folk. Whether they were schooled in philosophy or not, and no matter the deities they worshipped, most people living in the Greco-Roman world continued to envisage their gods as corporeal beings with bodies shaped like their own, much as they always had. But towards the close of the first millennium BCE and into the early centuries of the Common Era, these erudite philosophical ideas would gradually come to shape the thinking of certain Jewish and Christian intellectuals, so that they began to reimagine their deity in increasingly incorporeal, immaterial terms, drawing ever sharper distinctions between the heavenly and the earthly, the divine and the human, and the spiritual and the bodily. It's the broadly Platonic notion of the otherness and unlikeness of the divine to anything in or beyond the universe that has shaped the more formal theological constructions of God in the Western religious imagination. And yet, these constructions are built on a conceptual framework very much at odds with the Bible itself. For in these ancient texts, God is presented in startlingly anthropomorphic ways. This is a deity with a body. In the beginning. The High God had already spent several days speaking new marvels into being, separating the primeval waters of chaos into heavenly and underworld reservoirs, bringing forth dry land, planting it with fruit trees and crops, appointing the sun and the moon to light day and night, and commanding the new formed land, seas and skies to bring forth animals, fish and birds. Now he was about to speak again. "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness," he says to the other deities in his retinue. It's more a declaration than a suggestion, but a good idea nonetheless, for the humans will be tasked with keeping order in the newly created earthly realm. And so the High God makes the very first human. God created the human in his image, in the image of God he created him. The new creature, Adam, meaning man or human, bears a bodily resemblance to his divine creator and is swiftly paired with a female version. Male and female, he created them. Equipped with God-shaped bodies, humans are rendered superior to the other newly made creatures of the world, over whom they're appointed to rule. Blessing humans with fertility, the High God gives them two tasks: to procreate and dominate. They are to fill this new world with their offspring and keep the other creatures under control. Satisfied with his creative accomplishments, the High God decides his work is done. The next day, he rests. In academic circles, there's nothing particularly contentious about this paraphrase of the opening chapter of the book of Genesis. Most biblical scholars would agree that when God says, "Let us make humankind in our image, in our likeness," he's addressing the other members of the divine assembly, the biblical label given to God's council of lower-ranking deities and divine beings. And most would agree, even if some might squirm a little, that in being made in the image and likeness of the gods, freshly minted humans bear a visual resemblance to their own deities, just as Adam's son Seth is later said to be the image and likeness of his father, and in other biblical texts, divine statues are the image and likeness of the gods they represent. Written in about the 5th century BCE, but drawing on older mythologies, the creation story that now begins the Bible reflects a time when Yahweh, the deity of Jerusalem, now better known as God, had yet to be imagined as the only divine being in the universe. Like the Babylonian deity Marduk, or the Greek god Zeus, this ancient deity had long been cast as the king of the cosmos, but like them, he was far from alone in the heavens. Above all, he was still several centuries away from becoming the immaterial, incorporeal abstraction of later Jewish and Christian theologies. Instead, he was just like any other deity in the ancient world. He had a head, hair, and a face, eyes, ears, a nose, and a mouth. He had arms, hands, legs, and feet, and a chest and a back. He was equipped with a heart, a tongue, teeth, and genitals. He was a god who breathed in and out. This was a deity who not only looked like a human, albeit on a far more impressive, glamorous scale, but who very often behaved like a human. He enjoyed evening strolls and hearty meals. He listened to music, wrote books, and made lists. He was a god who not only spoke, but whistled, laughed, shouted, wept, and talked to himself. He was a god who fell in love and into fights, a god who squabbled with his worshippers and grappled with his enemies, a god who made friends, raised children, took wives, and had sex. This portrait of God has not been lifted from obscure myths inscribed on long-abandoned clay tablets. It's drawn from the Bible itself. A book as complex as the deity it promotes, not least because the Bible's not a book at all, but a collection of books falling into two parts. The first is the Hebrew Bible, known in Judaism as Tanakh, and in Christianity as the Old Testament, and it's an anthology of ancient texts originally crafted as scrolls. Most of these texts are themselves complex compilations of diverse literary traditions, and the majority were composed between the 8th and 2nd centuries BCE in Judah, a small southern polity in the ancient Levant, the region we know today as Palestine, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and western Syria. In the 8th century BCE, Judah was a kingdom captured by Assyria. At the beginning of the 6th century BCE, it was conquered again, this time by the Babylonians. By the 5th century BCE, Judah had become a Persian province, and in about 333 BCE, it was incorporated into Alexander the Great's vast empire. Some Hebrew Bible texts tell of Judah's changing political fortunes, while others are stories about legendary heroes and myths about the very distant past. Some are collections of oracles attributed to various prophets, and others are compilations of poetry, ritual songs, prayers, and teachings. But none of these texts have reached us in their original form. Instead, all were subject to creative and repeated revision, addition, emendation, and editing across a number of generations, reflecting the shifting ideological interests of their curators, who regarded them as sacred writings. It's this long process of creative curation that's given narrative shape to the biblical story of God's relationship with Israel, the people in whom he takes a special interest. The first five books of the Hebrew Bible tell of the founding of this relationship. Following the creation of the world and the great flood, God forges a covenant or contract relationship with the Israelites' ancestors, Abraham, his son Isaac, and grandson Jacob, promising them a multitude of descendants in return for their obedience, which is to be demonstrated primarily by their worship of him alone. When the Israelites find themselves enslaved in Egypt, God liberates them, tasking Moses both to lead them to the promised land of Canaan and to instruct them in God's teaching, Torah, the regulations which will shape their ongoing relationship with the deity, including instructions for the glorious temple they're to build in their divinely granted homeland. Collectively, these five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, are known as the Torah, and together they rework what were probably competing traditions about ancestors and origins into a broadly coherent narrative about Israelite identity. The crafting of the past is continued in the books of Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. Together, this second block of material tells of the conquest and settlement of Canaan and the reigns of the first Israelite monarchs, Saul, then David, who makes Jerusalem his capital, followed by Solomon, who builds God a temple there. These books continue with stories about the fracturing of the kingdom into two after Solomon's death: Israel in the north and Judah in the south. The fates of the kingdoms are traced, skipping briskly past the Assyrian defeat of the kingdom of Israel in the late 8th century BCE and ending in the early 6th century BCE with the Babylonian conquest of Judah, the destruction of Jerusalem, and the exile of its elites to Mesopotamia, events depicted as a punishment from God for generations of religious malpractice. The biblical portrayal of the past resumes in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which focus on the return of the exiles in the late 6th and 5th centuries BCE. In spite of their former transgressions, this group is now the divinely elected, purified remnant of the ancient people of God, a notion similarly expressed in some of the prophetic works dating to this period. Restored to divine favour and back in the homeland, they rebuild Jerusalem and its temple and recommit themselves to the divine teaching Moses had mediated. Historically, only the later episodes of this biblical story broadly dovetail with known realities, at best consigning Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, and even David and Solomon to the realms of fable, and at worst to sheer fantasy. But from the 9th century BCE onwards, archaeological evidence points to the existence of the separate Iron Age kingdoms of Israel and Judah, and corroborates the names of some of their kings. Mesopotamian records confirm the Assyrian destruction of Israel in the late 8th century BCE and the Babylonian defeat of Judah in the early 6th century BCE. Mesopotamian annals also attest to the forced migration of some higher status groups from both kingdoms, a common imperial strategy designed to curtail local uprisings in conquered territories, and there's sufficient evidence to suggest that some deportees did indeed return from Babylonia to Judah in the late 6th and early 5th century BCE. But non-biblical material can also flag the limitations of the Bible's portrayal of the past, warning us that it cannot be taken as a comprehensive or reliable record of history. In the books of Kings, for example, a 9th century BCE ruler of the northern kingdom of Israel, named Omri, is presented as a figure of marginal significance, whose only noteworthy accomplishment is the founding of a new capital city, Samaria. But an inscribed stela set up by Mesha, king of neighbouring Moab, celebrates the regaining of sizable Moabite territories from Omri, king of Israel, and his successor, both of whom had oppressed Moab for a long time. The longevity of Omri's territorial and dynastic legacy is also reflected in Assyrian texts of the 9th and 8th centuries BCE, in which the Kingdom of Israel is frequently designated Omri land and its various kings as sons of Omri. The possibility that the Judahite writer of the Books of Kings has not only minimised but suppressed Omri's significance is signalled by an oblique, fleeting reference to the rest of the acts of Omri and the power that he showed. The partisan perspectives of the biblical writers and editors are also evident in an overarching insistence that the Jerusalem temple served as the only legitimate site of Yahweh worship. Other ritual sites are downplayed as mere shrines or disparagingly dismissed as idolatrous and are said to have been closed down by especially virtuous kings of Judah. And yet, archaeological evidence corroborates the existence of several Yahweh temples throughout the first millennium BCE, including one in a state-sponsored fortress in Arad on Judah's southern border, dated to the 8th century BCE, another built by Judahite immigrants on the Egyptian island of Elephantine in the 5th century BCE, and yet another operating from the 5th to the 2nd centuries BCE on Mount Gerizim in the West Bank. Scholars are agreed that the religious realities of Yahweh worship were far more diverse and far less centralised than the biblical story asserts. To put it bluntly, the Hebrew Bible offers a highly ideological and frequently unreliable portrayal of the past. It's a story told from the perspective of pro-Jerusalem writers and editors, for it was the trauma of Judah's conquest in the 6th century BCE and Jerusalem's gradual regeneration in the Persian era that triggered the literary activities giving rise to the texts of the Hebrew Bible as we find them today. With the restoration of the city's temple, which served as both a religious and administrative centre, Jerusalem's priestly and scribal cultures flourished. During this Second Temple period, old texts were reshaped and new literary works were crafted, and much of this literature was filtered through the lens of exile, return, and restoration. But although these texts tend to present the exile and return as the experience of all Judahites, this wasn't the case. Only the elites and some among the professional classes had been deported to Babylonia, and the majority remained there. Meanwhile, other Judahite groups had already migrated to Egypt during the years of political upheaval, and many more would relocate to towns and cities across the prospering trade routes crisscrossing the Eastern Mediterranean, Mesopotamia, and the Levant. As the cultural contours of the imperial landscape shifted to Persia and then to Greece, Aramaic and Greek became the dominant literary languages of Jewish communities as those of Judahite descent had come to be known. Consequently, by the beginning of the Common Era, Many Jewish groups outside Roman Palestine, and some within, were reading and hearing their sacred texts in Aramaic and Greek translation. Among them were members of the Jesus Movement, a minor Jewish cult whose adherents believed their executed teacher had resurrected, heralding the imminent arrival of the kingdom of God and the universal justice and peace it would bring. The movement had emerged in Roman Palestine, but was recruiting devotees from both Gentile and Jewish communities across the empire. Although we know it better as Christianity, this movement would ostensibly remain a Jewish sect for several generations, and its members quite naturally regarded the texts we now find in the Hebrew Bible as their own sacred scriptures. Like other Jewish groups, the earliest Christians also produced their own writings, including those that would eventually comprise the New Testament. Written in Greek between the mid-1st and early 2nd centuries CE, these texts quickly circulated around the empire. The earliest are letters written by Paul to Christian groups in cities across the eastern Mediterranean in the mid-50s, 2 to 3 decades after Jesus was executed, urging his readers to ready themselves for impending and miraculous change. The Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as they would soon be called, offer varied portrayals of Jesus' life, supernatural powers, and teachings, and were written in the closing decades of the 1st century, while John probably dates to about 100 CE. By the early 2nd century CE, the other texts we now find in the New Testament have been produced, including some falsely attributed to Paul, others purportedly written by some of Jesus' disciples, and the apocalyptic account of the expected cosmic transformation known as the Book of Revelation. These texts were far from being the only authoritative gospels, epistles, and revelations circulating among early Christian communities, but they would become the most important. By the 3rd century CE, they were increasingly being described as the New Testament or Covenant, a label indexing their elevated status as sacred writings, both completing and eclipsing the Old Testament of Christianity's Jewish roots. Collectively known as the books in Greek Tabiblia, the Bible would arguably become the most significant book in global history, and its deity, the God of Western culture. God's body is nowhere denied in the Bible. It's simply assumed whether or not mortals were privileged enough to catch a glimpse of it, and according to biblical texts, many were. Following their exodus from Egypt, a committee of Israelite elders had ascended Mount Sinai and seen first God's feet and then the deity himself. Among them, of course, was Moses, who is said to have enjoyed regular meetings with God, talking to him face to face as one would speak to a friend. Moses is not the only one claimed to have experienced God's physical presence. In Genesis, Abraham walks alongside him and Jacob has a wrestling match with him. In the books bearing their names, the prophets Isaiah and Ezekiel each see God sitting on his throne, while Amos sees him standing in one of his temples. In the Gospels, Jesus not only boasts that he's seen God, but is also said to have seated himself alongside God in the heavens at his right hand. It's a companionable pairing reputedly witnessed by members of the Jesus movement, including a talkative young man called Stephen in the book of Acts, and the enraptured, if terrified, writer of Revelation, known as John of Patmos, both of whom see God sitting enthroned in the heavens, with Christ seated or standing next to him. In all these biblical stories, and many more besides, it was simply a given that God had a body. The sensational aspect in their telling was that God had allowed people to see it, such a rare privilege that during the Second Temple period, circa 515 BCE to 70 CE, God was increasingly understood to have long hidden his body from the world, rendering it unseeable, and hence invisible, to most mortals. But an unseen body is not the same as a non-existent body. Underpinning the hiddenness of God was a religious regulation which had crept its way into earlier versions of the Ten Commandments in the Second Temple period. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, whether in the likeness of what is in the heavens above, or what is on the earth below, or what is in the waters beneath the earth. It's a striking insertion, for it suggests that material images of God were once a normative feature of Israelite and Judahite religion, otherwise there would be no need for the ban. And in this, Israel and Judah were no different from their neighbours, for alongside other sacred objects, statues and figurines of deities had long played a part in Southwest Asian religions. It was well understood that the gods were usually unobservable in their natural, heavenly habitat, but they might deign to reveal themselves in the earthly realm as material images in a cult place or site of worship. More than a symbol or representation, a cult image was a material manifestation of divine presence. The statue was not only identified with the deity, but was the deity. It's all too easy to dismiss this as a characteristic of unsophisticated or primitive religious cultures, but this is to misunderstand the people of the past and their gods. This was a world in which perceptions of reality were neither limited nor defined by the physical, but stretched along a continuum from the natural to the supernatural. The cosmic membrane separating the earthly from the otherworldly was highly porous and malleable, so that divinity in all its myriad forms could break through into the world of humans, whether it was perceived as a strange scent on the wind, a fleeting shape glimpsed from the corner of the eye, or felt at a powerful place in the landscape. But divinity was at its most tangible when materialized in images of the gods. It was by means of cooperation between deities and worshippers, facilitated by ritual experts, that the earthly substance of the statue was transformed into a different category of being. As ritual specialists in Mesopotamia had put it, the divine statue was born in heaven and made on earth. As extraordinary beings, deities were thus unconstrained. They could remain unseen and at a distance in the heavens, while simultaneously revealing themselves as stars in the sky, statues in temples, figurines in the home, or unseen but perceptible forces permeating the earthly realm. The biblical ban on divine images is often held to signal the incorporeal nature of God, marking him out as a deity distinct from any other in the ancient world, a deity impossible to craft in clay or metal, wood or stone, by virtue of being bodiless. But the Bible's promotion of imageless worship indicates no such thing. The cults of various Egyptian, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Phoenician deities all experienced periods of aniconic worship, despite the fact that these deities were understood to have bodies. The prohibition of divine images in the Ten Commandments points instead to a growing emphasis on the hiddenness of God's body, as a closely related tradition in Deuteronomy indicates. Here, Moses reminds the Israelites of their encounter with God on the way to the Promised Land, when they had gathered at the foot of the holy mountain in the wilderness to listen as the deity spelled out the terms of the covenant. Having descended onto the mountaintop, God himself was veiled from view, for all the Israelites could see was the heavenly fire and dark cosmic cloud shrouding the mountain's peak. "Since you saw no form when Yahweh spoke to you from the middle of the fire," Moses says, "watch yourselves very closely, lest you act corruptly by making a carved image for yourselves." In this text, the imageless worship of God was to be preferred to creating a statue of a deity the Israelites hadn't actually seen, but had only heard speaking. This emerging theological emphasis on the hiddenness of God would eventually give rise to the abstract, incorporeal deity of Judaism and Christianity, a deity no longer shrouded by fire and clouds, but only wondrous, inscrutable mystery. But Judaism and Christianity are post-biblical religions, and their disembodied deity is a later reimagining of a God who was far from enigmatic. For the God of the Bible was a deity who not only had a body, but a personal name, a backstory, a family, and a host of companions in the heavens. Curriculum Vitae. God's real name is Yahweh, or Yahu, or perhaps just Yah. It's impossible to know for sure because the original Hebrew-speaking devotees of this god used a writing system comprising only consonants, much like modern Hebrew and Arabic today. And so in ancient inscriptions, the deity's name appears only as YHW or YH or YHWH, leaving us uncertain as to how it was vocalised. It's the longer form, YHWH, that's more commonly found in the ancient Hebrew literature of the Bible. But although many of these texts would be read aloud in worship, it remains difficult to know how the name was pronounced, for by the 3rd century BCE, when this deity had already been venerated for centuries, it had become unutterable, a name too dangerous and powerful for human mouths to articulate. But later scholars in the Greco-Roman world would have no such scruples. They appear to have vocalised it as Yahweh or Yahveh, and so Yahweh is the name by which this deity has come to be known. Given the thoroughgoing theological revision of the literature which now forms the Hebrew Bible, Yahweh is often assumed to have been a distinctively solitary deity, devoid of divine colleagues and a family. But the religious realities of his early history were very different. As one of many deities in the Late Bronze and Early Iron Age Levant, Yahweh was originally a god rooted within a polytheistic world, and remained comfortably so for much of his early career. This was a world in which the gods were imagined as a sprawling heavenly household, broadly reflecting the family bonds and social structures of their human worshippers. In most Levantine societies, this pantheon was headed by the aged progenitor of the cosmos, the god Ael, or in some dialects, Eel, a name functioning both as a proper noun and the generic Semitic term for deity. Beneath him were ranked a younger generation of gods, each charged with a particular portfolio in the management of the universe, from storms, seas, sunlight and starlight, to fertility, birth, warfare and death. As frontline deities, these were the most prominent gods of ancient Levantine societies and those most closely tied to the political and territorial identities of their worshippers. Thanks particularly to a wealth of literature dated to the 14th and 13th centuries BCE, recovered from the remains of an ancient city-state called Ugarit on the Syrian coast, Ael's multi-tiered household has come into sharper focus. He was understood to be the gentle father of the gods, enjoying a comfortable semi-retirement from the day-to-day running of the cosmos, accompanied by his consort, the mother goddess Atherat. Between them, they had 70 sons, a collective term for the frontline deities. These included Ugarit's special patron, the powerful storm god Baal, his sister Anat, a fearsome warrior, as well as the boisterous sea god Yam and the underworld king of death Mot, each of whom dwelt in his own domain located at the very edge of the divine realm. Ranked beneath them were the relatively minor deities of practical skills and cultural arts, including architecture and design, healing, music and magic, while below them was a collection of divine attendants and messengers who variously served the gods and commuted between the heavens and the earthly realm. Despite their differences in rank, the gods met together as a divine council or assembly, chaired by Ael in his role as the highest god, to decide on matters both divine and mortal. Ugarit's pantheon was typical of Levantine religions in the late 2nd and early 1st millennium BCE, when early forms of Yahweh worship merged. The pantheon's shape and composition was determined by the very human idea that to be a god isolated from any other was to be bereft of the benefits of collaboration, status, and kinship. In short, it was to be socially impotent and frankly useless, therefore, to mortals. Against this cultural backdrop, certain theological claims asserting that Yahweh had only ever been a solitary deity look more than a little implausible. And the Bible itself reveals that this God was far from alone. A fragment of ancient poetry in the book of Deuteronomy not only locates Yahweh within a pantheon, but also reveals exactly who his father was. It describes the separation of humans into distinct groups, peoples or nations, and explains why each group was allocated a particular deity to act as its special patron. But the deity supervising this division of divine labour is not Yahweh, but Elyon, a title of El, reflecting his role as the Most High God of the Pantheon. When Elyon, or Most High, apportioned the nations, when he divided humankind, he fixed the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the divine sons. For Yahweh's portion was his people, Jacob, or Israel, his allotted share. Here, Yahweh appears as just one among El's many divine children. Other ancient pieces of poetry in the Hebrew Bible tell us something of Yahweh's early career. They too employ mythic motifs that run against the theological preferences of later biblical writers and editors, suggesting that they reflect older traditions about the earliest history of the biblical God. Far from portraying Yahweh as the supreme king and creator of the cosmos, they present him instead as a minor but ferocious storm deity at the margins of the inhabited world, in an ancient place variously known as Seir, Paran, and Teman, cast in the Bible as a dangerous, mountainous wilderness, seemingly located south of the Negev Desert, beyond the Dead Sea, in what used to be called Edom and is now southern Jordan. As a god of such a place, Yahweh might have been akin to a group of disruptive deities known in the southern Levant as the Shaddai gods, a name identifying them as deities of the steppe or wilderness. And naturally, they too were subordinate to El. A remarkable discovery at Deir Alla, the site of an ancient city in the eastern Jordan Valley, offers a glimpse of these desert-dwelling deities. Inside a building destroyed by an earthquake in about 800 BCE, archaeologists found several fragments of a lengthy inscription, which had once adorned a plastered wall. Pieced together, it describes a series of visions received by a seer called Bilam ben Beor, who would later make a cameo appearance in the biblical book of Numbers as a prophet of El. The inscription reveals that a delegation of deities had warned Bilam that the Shaddai gods had banded together against their high god El and were threatening to sew up the heavens in thick cloud, casting the world into darkness. "So will be done with naught surviving. No one has seen the likes of what you've heard," the gods declare to the panicked seer. While the heavenly rebellion and its associated cosmic calamity is typical of ancient Southwest Asian myths, it's the portrayal of El as the heavenly overlord of the Shaddai gods that's particularly remarkable, for it parallels one of the most prominent titles given to El in the Hebrew Bible. In Genesis, the God of the Israelite patriarchs Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is not usually named Yahweh, but El Shaddai, as the deity himself insists. "I am El Shaddai," the God of the Bible announces to Abraham. "I will make my covenant between me and you, and will make you exceedingly numerous." The deity makes a similar promise to Jacob. "I am El Shaddai, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall come from you, and kings shall spring from you." Traditionally, if mistakenly, translated as God Almighty, El Shaddai means something like El of the Wilderness, and appears to have been the name of a well-known local manifestation of the great high god El in and around the territories identified today as Palestine, Israel, and Jordan. It's El to whom Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob build altars and make offerings in the land of Canaan, marking it out as the territory their divinely promised descendants will inherit. And it's El whom even these biblical writers recognize as being the God of their assumed ancestors. Scholars have long suspected that El, not Yahweh, was the original God of the people known in the Bible as Israel. His name not only occurs in the traditions of the patriarchs, but is embedded in the name of Israel itself, Yitzra'el, and is explicitly revealed in the divine name of a temple Jacob is said to have built at the ancient city of Shechem in what is now the West Bank. He erected an altar there and called it El, God of Israel. Yahweh would gradually come to usurp his father El by supplanting him as the head of the pantheon. But quite how this happened remains frustratingly unclear. It's possible that the transition was tied to the socio-political conditions that gave rise to the emergence of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah early in the first millennium BCE. With kingship and statecraft came ideologies of militarized power and the need for kings to exhibit themselves as warriors endorsed by fearsome divine fighters. As a storm god, Yahweh was naturally a god of warfare, equipped with weapons of thunder, lightning, and rain clouds, and it was Yahweh's personal patronage the kings of Israel and Judah claimed. And as the patron deity of these kings, so Yahweh became the tutelary god of their small kingdoms, and the deity increasingly promoted at the ancient temples and sanctuaries within their bounds, whose economic and ritual heft further enabled and enhanced the performance of royal power. While this might account for the political prioritization of Yahweh, and even the deity's acquisition of some of Ael's traditional roles, titles, and sanctuaries, it's still unknown exactly how or when Yahweh came to be understood as the head of the pantheon. And it's impossible to say whether or not this view of the pantheon was shared by ordinary Israelites and Judahites, for whom the religious ideologies of statehood remained relatively unimportant. What is more certain is that cultural memories of Ael's traditional role persisted, suggesting that they remained too potent or too deeply ingrained to be ignored or excised from the religious traditions on which biblical authors and editors subsequently drew. Instead, a different theological strategy was employed. In a spectacularly transparent attempt at spin doctoring, some writers sought to downplay Yahweh's apparent supplanting of his mythic father by insisting that Yahweh was Ael all along. "I am Yahweh," the deity says to Moses in Exodus. "I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, but by my name Yahweh I did not make myself known to them." Yahweh's origins might well be murky, but by the 9th century BCE, he was firmly established as the head of the local pantheons of two kingdoms located in the territories belonging today to modern Israel and Palestine. Judah, with Jerusalem serving as its capital, and to its north, Israel, governed primarily from the city of Samaria, the impressive remains of which are located in today's West Bank. Of the two, the kingdom of Israel was by far the stronger. With 10 times the people power of Judah, its flourishing economy was rooted in the fertile soils of its hilly spine and lush lowlands, which together produced the olive oil, wine, and wheat on which its economy and trade depended. Israel was a relatively prominent player on the southern Levantine stage, while Judah was often little more than its smaller, weaker, poorer neighbour. These kingdoms were just two of a number of regional polities, among them the Philistines, who lived along the coast of present-day southern Israel and the Gaza Strip, the kingdoms of Ammon, Moab, and Edom in what is now modern Jordan, the Phoenicians, whose principal cities now lie within modern Lebanon and coastal southern Syria, and the Aramaeans, who dominated much of the rest of Syria. By the 8th century BCE, these peoples were subsumed within the vast expanse of the Assyrian Empire, which now stretched from its Mesopotamian homeland in today's Iraq to encompass the lands we now know as Iran, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, the Palestinian territories, and Jordan. But the imperial subjugation of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah did not dislodge the cultural characteristics indigenous to these small southern Levantine societies. Within both kingdoms, which shared not only an oft-contested border, but a language, Hebrew, treaties and trade agreements, similar social and religious practices, and myths about common ancestors and gods, Yahweh was acclaimed as the national or state deity and the divine patron of each kingdom's royal household. A number of other deities, who likely played their part in the polytheistic governance of the cosmos, were worshipped alongside him, with the most prominent among them being Yahweh's wife, the goddess Asherah. The biblical writers cannot help but reveal that she was worshipped alongside Yahweh in his temples in Jerusalem and Samaria, while inscriptions dating to the 8th century BCE attest to worshippers seeking blessings from Yahweh and his Asherah. This goddess was a local iteration of one of the oldest deities in the Levant, beloved for millennia by numerous societies across the region. Indeed, her name betrays something of her former life. Asherah is the Hebrew version of Atherat, the name of the mother of the god Sa'ugarit and Ael's consort. It would appear that, in supplanting his mythological father, Yahweh also took his wife. While the domestic arrangements of this biblical Oedipus might have been perfectly straightforward for an ancient deity and his worshippers, they would prove intolerable for later biblical writers, who engaged in so determined a campaign of defamation against the goddess that she would come to be locked out of the heavens forever. Historically, the goddess's fall broadly reflects the decline of traditional state-sponsored polytheism, a decline triggered by the Assyrian annihilation of the Kingdom of Israel in about 722 BCE and the Babylonian destruction of Judah in 587 BCE. As patron deity and divine warrior of his peoples, Yahweh has seemingly failed to protect them. It would prompt a profound theological and cultural shift among certain priestly and scribal groups, some of them in exile, whose work would begin to shape the central traditions reflected in the Hebrew Bible and eventually craft a new image of their God, the deity who would become the God of the Bible. Despite the destruction of his kingdoms, Yahweh himself had not been defeated, they insisted. Rather, he had engineered the collapse of the states of Israel and Judah in punishment of his worshippers' religious deviancy, the worship of other gods. Yahweh would come to be presented as a god intolerant of other deities, and Yahweh worship would become increasingly monolatrous. Readers of the Bible might be surprised by this brief historical overview of Yahweh's early career. After all, the ancient editorial voices dominating the biblical portrayal of the past insist on a competing alternative story in which it's claimed that from the beginning, God was only ever a solitary, unchanging deity, devoid of divine colleagues, a universal being in exclusive command of the cosmos, its course and its creatures. But this story is a product of a later theological worldview, and its narrative of religious history is unreliable. The texts that form the Bible were never intended to be a coherent account of the past, and they don't agree on either the central features or the smaller details of the religious landscape they present. Just as an atlas can only offer a constructed version of the world, compiled from a selection of political, cultural, and social preferences and frozen moments in time, for example, the changing names and borders of nations, or the shifting shapes of coastlines and ice caps, so too the Bible comprises a diverse collection of material, crafted and reworked over time with the force and flux of competing ideologies. By mapping God's body rather than the Bible itself, we can better navigate the transformation of this ancient southern Levantine deity into the God with whom we're now culturally more familiar. Despite the theological changes wrought by the emergence of ancient Judaism and early Christianity, the one aspect of this deity that remained unchanged was his corporeality. By virtue of having a body, he endured as a powerful social agent in the lives of his worshippers across the centuries of the Bible's formation. In exploring the body of this ancient deity as his worshippers imagined him, we can access their world. We can meet the real God of the Bible.